Plato. Welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. Research in this week's issue of the journal Nature might force biology textbook publishers to make a few changes to next year's edition. Geneticists at Purdue University, working on a common mustard plant, have found that the plant was somehow able to repair or replace bad copies of genes that it had inherited from its parents. The plant essentially reached back into some hidden genetic code, found a normal copy of the genes to use instead, and produced the right kinds of flowers that had been produced beforehand. In other words, it corrected its own mutation. That discovery goes against everything biologists thought they knew about genes and mutations and how they're passed from parent to offspring, all the way back to Gregor Mendel and his peas over 100 years ago. Joining me now to talk more about this head-scratching finding is the man who made the discovery, Robert Pruitt, Associate Professor of Plant Molecular Genetics at Purdue University. He joins us from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to the program, Dr. Pruitt.
Thanks for having me.
How about a little biology primer here for us?
Okay.
Well, you know, may have graduated high school a while ago and don't, you know, you have a plant, it's born, and it has two sets of genes. Tell us about that, how it should work.
Right. So basically every plant should have two copies of every gene, and one comes from its mother and one from its father. And, of course, our traditional view of that is that the genes that are passed on are not changed in any way. They just come directly from the parent plants. And so in this particular study that was just published, which was a collaboration with Dr. Susan Lawley, what we were looking at were mutations in a particular gene called hothead. And we were looking at plants where both of the copies were defective. They were both mutant. And then we allow those plants to self-fertilize. So basically all of their progeny should get just mutant copies of the gene. And yet about 10% of the progeny somehow actually recover a normal copy of the gene, a so-called wild-type copy, and they've repaired the defect.
Let me just back up for a second. Would this be akin to two parents who have blue eyes and their genes mixing and they have blue-eyed children? Or is it even more?
No, it's different from that.
Yes.
So in that case, usually what we're looking at is a case of what we call dominance and recessiveness, where if you have two copies of a gene and one is dominant and the other is recessive, the dominant one actually determines what kind of character trait you have, like blue eyes or brown eyes. And so you can have two parents who both have sort of hidden genes, and then when they produce offspring, if the offspring get those hidden genes in the right combination, then they'll have a different trait from what their parents had. But in this case, we're talking about plants that basically only have the defective copy. That's all they can pass on, in theory, and yet somehow they manage to pass on a wild-type copy.
But the grandparents of these plants had other, let's say, normal copies.
Right.
So somehow the grandparents' normal copy was passed to the grandchildren.
Well, at least that's the model we have, and that's what's consistent with the data, that somehow that copy, that information is being stored in some way other than what we're used to thinking about, other than the DNA that we find in the chromosomes, and that information is being passed on to the parent plant, which doesn't have a good copy of the gene, but somehow can still pass on that information to its progeny.
Any speculation on how this might be happening?
Well, so the data that we have suggests that the process is very accurate. It's what we would refer to as template-directed. And so that means that the information has to be stored, we assume, in some kind of biological template. And the only ones we know about are the molecules DNA and RNA. Mm-hmm. And we've looked pretty extensively to try and find a DNA template, and there doesn't seem to be one. And so the logical alternative is that there's some kind of RNA template, but we certainly don't have any direct evidence that supports that at this time.
Now, the RNA is basically sort of the workhorse for the DNA, right? It takes the blueprint that's in the DNA, and it goes out and carries out those instructions.
That's right. That's the normal role that RNA plays.
But the possibility is here is that maybe the RNA is being carried through as the blueprint itself?
Well, or at least a backup of the blueprint, not necessarily the primary copy, obviously, but just something that's kept in reserve and can be used as a repair kit to patch up things that aren't working out very well for the organism.
So in the grandparent, for example, you may have two copies of the RNA. Maybe it goes out and does something with the DNA as instructions, but then there's another backup copy that's waiting in reserve.
Well, yeah, or it may be that, I mean, RNA comes in a number of different forms, and it's possible that this information that we're postulating the existence of is actually in some new form of RNA that we just simply haven't characterized at all yet, and that's clearly a direction that we need to go in terms of future research, is finding where this information is and how it's stored.
And how do you go about looking for that?
Well, so the prediction would be that these parents, which have only defective copies of the gene, and at least in their DNA, and yet produce progeny that are normal, they must actually have that DNA sequence information someplace. And again, so we can use various molecular techniques to try and find that sequence information that represents the normal copy and look places other than in the normal place we'd look, which is in the chromosomal DNA. And that's, you know, we have a long ways to go in that. We're just beginning.
Can you give us some ideas of where you might even look for that stuff?
Well, so, I mean, we're going to look in RNA, and to start with, we won't really worry about where. We'll just basically try and prepare RNA from the entire plant and see if we can find this missing information. And if we can, then at that point, we'll have to start trying to track it down and determine all kinds of things about where it is, what its structure is, how's it replicated. It'll be a lot of fun, frankly.
You know, didn't we discover other kinds of RNA recently that might be, you know, that we didn't know existed? Maybe there may be more kinds of RNA.
Right. We certainly have discovered that RNA does much more than we thought it did 10 or 15 years ago. It's involved in all sorts of genetic regulatory processes, turning genes on and off in interesting ways and ways that are very important to the development of the organism. And it's another example of something that, you know, if a scientist had proposed that was going to be the case 15 years ago, people probably would have laughed. But now there's such solid evidence that it does these things that it's, you know, it's in the textbook.
What was your reaction when you saw these plants? That should not be there.
Yeah, that's right. They should not be there. Well, and I think that the reaction of everyone in the lab was skepticism. I mean, that, you know, they shouldn't be there. And initially there were lots of trivial explanations for where they were coming from, including just simple contamination. And so initially, I think our reaction was just, well, let's figure out what we've done wrong so that we can do the experiment right. And, you know, then through a painstaking process of a lot of experiments, you know, you rule out all the trivial explanations, and eventually you rule out even the non-trivial ones, and you're left with no explanation at all. And that's where we're at, really. We're proposing a novel sort of mode of inheritance, but what we really know is just that it's something different from the conventional way things are inherited.
What was the point of your experiment to begin with? Were you looking for something like this? Because, you know, it was obviously some surprise.
No, not at all. We were studying, we in the lab, we mostly study a process called organ fusion, where different parts of the plant become fused tightly together due to some developmental aberrations. And this gene, Hothead, is a gene which, when you knock it out, it produces plants which have a problem with this organ fusion process. And that's really what we were studying. And the observation that it didn't breed true was just, it came out of that work. And then, you know, it was just a matter of, I guess, the kind of people that both Susan and I are. We just wanted to be persistent and track that down and make sure that we understood what was going on.
Now, this was the flower that was deformed, right, on the plant?
For the most part, in this plant, it's the flowers that are messed up, yeah.
Yeah, and so you see the flowers that are messed up in some of these, and you say, you know, gee, we thought maybe there was contamination. So you do it over and over and over again just to make sure that it wasn't?
Well, and you look at other sorts of information that you have to try and rule out possible contamination. So, for example, in this case, we can look at these progeny plants, which look normal. And it turns out that, of course, one of the two copies of the genes in most cases has reverted to normal, but the other one is still mutant. And then we can look at that mutant copy and show that it's exactly the same as the mutant copy that the parent had. So it's unlikely to be just a random seed that fell in from someplace, because it still carries this mutation. It's just now only in one of the two copies of the gene. So through experiments like that and others, we can rule out, you know, we can basically trace the lineage of these plants and rule out that they're coming from contamination of some sort.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess you're getting a lot of reaction from this publication.
A lot more than I would have expected, to be honest. It's to me, it's, you know, it's very exciting to geneticists. I expected that geneticists would be very interested, but that's sort of where I would have thought the limit was. You know, to me, it's a pretty esoteric piece of genetics.
Well, would you expect it first to, you know, why should this mustard plant be any different than other plants? Now, wouldn't it be, you know, logical to look for this kind of thing in other plants?
I think it's logical, yeah. I think that it's likely to occur in a wide variety of organisms, but at the same time, I think, you know, at this point, we have to be a little cautious because all we've looked at is what happens in Arabidopsis, and we have no direct data to assume that it's going to occur anywhere else. But at the same time, that said, I'd be rather surprised if it is an Arabidopsis-specific phenomenon. I would guess it at least occurs in other plants and possibly in animals as well.
And people might now start looking for animal models to see where this happens.
I hope so.
You need some fast, you know, I guess your lab rat now is up there, they're going to be making more mice, a lot more mice. What will it take to cement this as part of a textbook now? You know, a lot more experimentation.
Absolutely. I think that's true. I mean, I think that the big questions from my point of view, one, we have to find where is the information stored. We really have to get our hands on that biochemically. You know, once you know, right now, like I say, it's sort of a very elaborate case of negative results, right? We've ruled out, we know this phenomenon happens, and we've ruled out all the conventional explanations we know about, and we're proposing this new mode of inheritance, but now we really need to get our hands on the molecules that make it happen, and then, you know, you really have something tangible that you can latch onto and say, look, here it is, this is what does it.
And are there a lot of labs now doing reproducing this experiment?
Well, I don't know of any, but I assume there will be without too much time passing.
This plant is like the mouse equipment, the laboratory mouse equipment of plants in your lab. It's just one of these standard plants that people use to experiment, right?
Yeah, Arabidopsis has quite a long history in genetics, but it was not tremendously popular until the early 1980s, and then it really took off. And now, it's used in thousands of labs worldwide, and it's a very standard tool for plant geneticists.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Pruitt, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Robert Pruitt is Associate Professor of Plant Molecular Genetics at Lafayette University. I'm Ira Flatow, reminding you to visit sciencefriday.com, where you'll find Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curricula for teachers and parents to use based on our programming. Just click on the Teachers button on the left side of the page. And thanks for listening.